Lecture 13, Dakani and Southern States.
As we've been looking at the long history of the Indian subcontinent, we have seen the many differences between the many relatively stable, regionally based cultures on one hand, and on the other, the relatively few and far more fragile trans-regional empires. Each of India's dozen or so ecologically defined regions developed its own language and culture. Often, political boundaries correlated with those. So even when royal dynasties changed, the kingdom remained largely the same. Very rarely did any ruler have the power to expand beyond his region to create an empire. As a result, India was unified very seldom in its long history. The Mauryan Empire was the first that even briefly spanned most of the subcontinent. But the Mauryan Empire fragmented in the 2nd century BCE. This began a millennium during which many different regionally based kingdoms briefly expanded and then shrank. A few kings managed to assemble armies that dominated their neighbors. But after a less effective king inherited the throne, these larger states broke apart into their constituent regions. They lacked the administrative, logistical, and ideological resources to stabilize their regimes beyond their core region for very long. These many different competing kingdoms in India make the post-Mauryan centuries seem very chaotic, with no single historical narrative to follow. And in solely political and military terms, the number of names and battle campaigns can be overwhelming. On the other hand, these ebbs and flows make Indian history especially rich and diverse. Further, we can see continuing patterns that bring meaning out of the welter of details. While there are peaks and troughs, overall the economy grew. In each region, forest-dwelling people, pastoralists, and settled farmers competed and also benefited from exchanges. As cities and artisanal production arose, trade expanded within most regions, among regions, and even intercontinentally by sea and land. The economy became increasingly monetized, which led to the growing importance of money lending and banking. Moreover, India lay at the center of economic exchange routes that had the Mediterranean at the western end, and to the east, China and Southeast Asia. As different social classes and groups gained advantages, they sought ideological and religious systems that were appealing to them. Across the Indian subcontinent, Brahmins tried to consolidate their Hindu model of society and of kingship by absorbing many of the most persuasive features of other rival religious traditions and movements. Simultaneously, competing Buddhist and Jain scholars and holy men continued to struggle for popular and royal support for their alternative beliefs and social and political models. Evidence about some of these rivalries has been preserved in the dynastic histories. For example, successive kings claimed origins and ancestries that accorded with one or another religious tradition, and sometimes several of them at once. Popular movements that followed models of devotion to particular deities inspired people at all levels of society. Yet another continuing pattern was the tension between resilient local cultures and kingdoms on one hand, and the pressures from outsiders on the other. Regionally based rulers might ritually submit to a more powerful outside conqueror, but they remained ready to repudiate that overlordship and reassert their own autonomy. When outsiders invaded and settled in a region, they often gradually adapted to the local language and other cultural features in order to convince their subjects of their royal legitimacy. So regions remained the political units, even when temporarily brought under an outside ruler or originally alien dynasty. All of these broader processes occurred within each of the four macro-regions of the Indian subcontinent during the post-Mauryan age. Remember, these macro-regions were the Indus River in the northwest, the Gangetic North India, the Deccan Highland, and the peninsular south. In the next lecture, we'll focus on the two macro regions of the Indus Northwest and the Gangetic North. In this lecture, we'll concentrate first on the Deccan Highland and then turn to the far south. While the upland Deccan and the south were in many ways distinct, they were not isolated from each other. First, rivers and trade linked them. Many of the most important rivers flow east or southeast from the upland Deccan to the seashore. Merchants conveyed crops and products up and down these rivers between the interior and the coast. These ecological and commercial corridors meant that kings based at either end often tried to expand along them in order to control the whole river system. Of course, there was a cultural gradient rather than a sharp divide between these two macro regions. The northern Deccan incorporated both Sanskritic North Indian and also Adivasi and Dravidian cultures. As you look southward, you see less of North Indian culture and more Adivasi and Dravidian features. This is clearly evident in the dominant language. In the North Deccan, the major languages like Marathi, Hindi, and Oriya are derived from Sanskrit. However, from even earlier, many Dravidian language-speaking people had settled in the southern Deccan and in South India's various and diverse ecological niches. There, they developed the four major languages in the Dravidian language family: Telugu in the southeast Deccan, Kannada in the southwest Deccan, while in the peninsular part of India, there is Tamil in the center and east, and Malayalam along the southwestern coast. None of these Dravidian languages are linguistically related to Sanskrit, although word borrowing went on. In addition, there are many dialects and smaller languages scattered across the Deccan and South India. These included the various surviving languages of the Adivasi forest dwellers, who were the first inhabitants in all of India. As you'll recall, Sanskrit culture and the Brahmanic system of the four Varnas emerged during the late Vedic period. But these had different configurations and potency in their original heartland in the North Indian Gangetic Plain than in the Deccan or in distant South India. Most strikingly, in South India, the few Brahmins there identified most of the population as Shudra or below, including as so-called outcasts and Adivasis. But this does not mean, of course, that South India had no priests, kings, warriors, or merchants. Only that the Dravidian society there did not conform easily to the Brahmanic model, and that Sanskrit was a language from outside the culture, a language that only a small, elite percentage of the population used. To illustrate these larger historical processes during the post-Mauryan millennium, we can select a few prominent historical examples for the Deccan and for South India, highlighting their distinctive features and interactions. With the fragmentation of the Mauryan Empire in the 1st century BCE, various briefly subordinated, regionally based rulers and governors asserted their own autonomy. Most prominent of these in the Deccan was the Satavahana dynasty. They had apparently been locally powerful chieftains who accepted the overlordship of Emperor Ashok Maurya. They were originally based in the western part of the Deccan Plateau, today inland in the Maharashtra province of India. When the Mauryan dynasty ended, the Satavahanas reasserted their own kingship. Then they spread their regime eastward. Eventually, they also became known as the Andhra dynasty, which is the name for the eastern part of the Deccan. So the dynasty evidently came to identify culturally with that part of the Deccan as well. The Satavahanas' proclaimed genealogy also reflected their efforts to buttress their social status in terms of both Hinduism and Buddhism. They claimed to have been Brahmins, the highest ranked Varna. But some rulers in this dynasty also patronized symbols of Hindu royalty, like the great horse sacrifice of Kshatriyas. So they were evidently seeking to use their political power and wealth to locate themselves at the top of the orthodox Hindu social order, indicating that they were part of both top Varnas. Some Satavahana kings also patronized Buddhism and its institutions, emulating the famous Emperor Ashoka. For example, royal and other donors created beautifully carved caves at Karle near their original heartland. Among these was a Buddhist chaitya, or prayer hall, carved out of the living rock. There, Buddhist monks and nuns would reassemble in reverence to a reputed relic of the Buddha himself, and thereby also support the regime. Architecturally, this particular chaitya illustrates a transition from wooden buildings into ones carved out of the rock cliff. Indeed, the artisans reproduced every facet and feature of the customary wooden structure. Thus, we can see beams and representations of the nail heads that would have been necessary in a wooden building, but not in a carved-out cave. The Satavahanas also reached militarily and politically toward both the north and the south. To their northwest, they faced the incoming Shakas. As we'll see in the next lecture, the Shakas, known in the west as Scythians, were Central Asians who erupted into India from the northwest and settled in what is today Gujarat and Rajasthan. The Satavahanas and the Shaka kings alternated victories with defeats, with no ruler being able to hold on to his military conquests for very long. Like the Mauryans, the Satavahanas' imperial rule was dependent on local kings accepting their overlordship. In contrast, the Satavahanas achieved greater military success advancing southward down the Godavari River to the southeast coast of India. By spanning the Deccan from coast to coast, the Satavahana Empire prospered through overseas trade. Even the Roman Empire recognized the Satavahanas as valued trading partners, as Ptolemy notes in the 2nd century CE. Simultaneously, Satavahana trade with Southeast Asia also grew from ports along Deccan's eastern shore. But the loosely controlled Satavahana Empire could not last. After more than four centuries of warfare, Shaka armies pushing down from the northwest weakened and fragmented the Satavahanas about 220 CE, although a rump of the Satavahana state lasted a few decades longer. Various of its subordinates broke away. One of its successors in the southeast was the Pallava dynasty. For about 600 years, from the 4th to the 9th centuries CE, Pallava dynasties dominated the agriculturally and commercially rich lands around Kanchipuram in India's southeast. This region receives irrigation both from rivers flowing down from the Deccan and also from seasonal rains during the northeast monsoon. That makes rice growing especially productive. Additionally, inland and overseas trade brought riches. The origins of the Pallavas are ambiguous, perhaps intentionally obscured by a series of different families over the centuries that each tried to claim that same dynastic name. Each family may have tried to evoke authority in its own cultural systems. For example, one Pallava family tradition maintained that they were royalty from North India who had emigrated and conquered the Kanchipuram region. Perhaps this claim echoes the famous Sanskrit language Ramayana, which, as you'll recall, recounts a divine North Indian prince as he conquered the south. Early Pallava kings claimed to have performed Brahmanic kingship rituals customarily only performed by Hindu Kshatriyas. But an alternative genealogical account found in some Pallava inscriptions has them related to Emperor Ashok Maurya. They thus claimed the prestige of that North Indian imperial dynasty. Indeed, Buddhist tradition in the region has Ashok himself building a Buddhist stupa near Kanchipuram. So this Pallava putative ancestry also evoked Buddhist universal sovereign models. However, yet another Pallava account has a local Hindu prince, or in some versions a Brahmin, fall in love with a Naga princess, that is, a daughter of the legendary chief of the serpents in the underworld. The princess became pregnant. When the prince left her, he told her to tie a soft twig around their child when he was born and set him adrift down a river toward the coast. When the prince later found the baby, he recognized him from the twig. The prince gave his son part of his kingdom, the region around Kanchipuram known as Tondai Mandalam, the region of Tondai, which means twig in the local Tamil language. This rescued child thus founded the Pallava dynasty, with the name Pallava also meaning young twig in Tamil. So the name of the dynasty and the region it governed were linked by this tradition. Some outside scholars interpret this origin story as revealing that the family probably arose among a forest people. But as their power grew, they claimed royal ancestry in more Brahmanic terms. More certain is that the first Pallavas were local subordinates of the Satavahana conquerors. The earliest firm historical evidence of the Pallava dynasty has been preserved on copper plates that we can date to about 275 CE. This was just when the Satavahana Empire was fragmenting and its subordinated kings were breaking free. Over the next centuries, Pallava armies sporadically conquered north and south up and down the Tamil coast. At their peak in the late 6th century, their armies conquered westward up the rivers into the dry interior, even as far as the western Ghats, covering about 7,000 square miles. The Pallavas also created a navy in order to extend their power to the island of Sri Lanka. And beyond their core region, Pallava overlordship tended to be relatively thin, enforced by armies, but also by the soft power of their culture. For example, one especially prominent Pallava king, Mahendravarman I, who ruled from 600 to 630 CE, proved himself a cultured man as well as a successful warrior. Some of his surviving inscriptions describe how he was born a Jain, but then converted to the Hindu sect of Shaivism due to the influence of Saint Upper. Upper was a famous poet and leader of a Tamil religious movement devoted to Shiva, the major Hindu god of creative destruction. Upper had himself also converted from Jainism. Even if this may not prove to be an historically accurate biography of Mahendravarman, it shows how Jain and Hindu Shaivite religious communities were in tension, each seeking to bring the Pallava king into its community. But the Shaivites seem to have won, since the Pallava royal seal showed the lingam, or the phallic symbol, of Shiva, and also an image of his vehicle, the bull Nandi. Additionally, Mahendravarman reputedly authored a Sanskrit language play showing how he had mastered that elite high culture respected across India. He also commissioned rock-cut temples showing Brahmanic Hindu gods and goddesses and illustrating some of their famous achievements. The huge stone carvings of divine chariots and temples at Mahabalipuram, for example, show how the Pallavas wished to be remembered. Also showing their mixed cultural claims, later Pallava copperplate land-grant inscriptions began with a eulogy to the king in Sanskrit, followed by details of the grant in Tamil, with a concluding verse in Sanskrit. Some of these copper plates, bound together with a ring, recorded gifts of land to Brahmin teachers and priests who performed rituals for the king. Eventually, Pallava kings lost power and their empire fragmented by the late 9th century. Yet their Tondai Mandalam region remained agriculturally rich with prosperous land and overseas trading networks, although now under the rule of former Pallava subordinates. Among their successors were the Cholas, based in the temple town of Tanjavur, or Tanjore. They largely took over the coastal plain of the southeast part of the peninsula and extended their trade and naval power extensively in Southeast Asia. They were again a series of families that claimed the same dynastic title. Under the Cholas, temples became ever more large and elaborate. Some were vastly wealthy from donations. For example, the Tanjavur temple reportedly had an annual income from 300 villages that totaled 500 pounds of gold, 250 pounds of jewels, and 600 pounds of silver annually. This one temple alone employed 600 people, including priests, temple dancers, and 57 musicians and text readers. This type of huge royal temple then expanded beyond the Chola kingdom. Another sometime rival, sometime subordinate of the Pallavas and an eventual successor dynasty were the Pandyans. They were based not on the wetter coast, but rather in the drier upland interior of the Tamil-speaking region. The royal Pandyan dynasty is mentioned in texts dating from the 4th century BCE, and the dynastic title lasted in one form or another through a series of families for about 1,500 years. The Cholas and Pandyas serve as excellent examples of the Dravidian model of kingship that was strongest in peninsular South India. Now, as various local communities settled in South India and elsewhere, they often focused on a local deity. Like their worshippers, emically, these deities spoke the local language, in the case of the Pallavas and the Pandyans, Tamil. Many were fierce warrior goddesses who ate the meat offered them by their non-vegetarian devotees. So their martial and cosmic energy, or Shakti, was enhanced. Many of these goddesses were also unmarried, so their Shakti was not controlled by a husband. This made them especially powerful, but also dangerous to those who opposed or disregarded them. Not just in South India, but in other regions of India as well, some such local goddesses represented major diseases, for example, smallpox. Any devotee who survived that disease did so through the grace of the goddess. The smallpox scars were permanent signs of her mercy. Clearly, such a deity was an awesome guardian and a fearsome foe. Interestingly, now that smallpox has been eradicated in India, some of these same deities now control any feverish disease. Others are now especially associated with HIV/AIDS. In the Dravidian state model, the local deity stood as the divine sovereign, while the king customarily served as the divinity's first-ranked human worshiper and earthly agent. It was due to the power and grace of the god or goddess that the king could lead armies that conquered on earth. But the deity was the one who really ruled. The capital city of the kingdom centered on the deity's home, with the king's palace customarily off to one side. Over time, however, many South Indian kings, like the Cholas and Pandyans, wished to attract into their kingdoms Brahmins and their ritual prestige and authority. Such kings conventionally gave gifts of tax-free land in order to entice these Brahmins to settle there. An all-Brahmin community became known as an Agrahara. Each Agrahara was surrounded by its fields and dependent villages, where the lower-ranked tenants did the farming, but lives outside of the Agrahara. In many cases, Brahmin priests gained control over already important local religious sites and temples. The model of the fierce, meat-eating, unmarried local goddess, however, did not conform to conventional Brahmanic concepts of the divine. So in Edic terms, we can perceive a process by which these local deities were incorporated into that Brahmanic model. This is a process named Sanskritization by the distinguished Indian anthropologist M.N. Srinivas, since Sanskrit is the premier and sacred Brahmanic language. To Sanskritize is for a lower-ranked family or community to aspire to upward ritual and social mobility by imitating the ways of life of Brahmins or Kshatriyas. In cases where the local deity is male, he might be Sanskritized into a manifestation or a son of the Brahmanic male god, especially Vishnu or Shiva. If the local deity is female, she might be ritually wedded to a male Brahmanic god. The goddess, now the consort of a Brahmanic god, usually became vegetarian, passed her Shakti over to her divine husband, became benign, and spoke Sanskrit, at least in the eyes of Brahmins. But many local people still envisioned the deity in her earlier local identity as their own. For them, the goddess was still unmarried, meat-eating, powerful, dangerous, and a speaker of their own Dravidian language. Thus, the king's strategy of enhancing his status in Brahmanic terms led to many important deities in South India being simultaneously Brahmanic and local. This sometimes led to tension over possession of the identity and property of that deity. Various individuals and groups in the local society held or gained social status based on the value of their donations to the deity. Those who made larger donations received prestige over those who gave less. People's relative rank was publicly expressed by where they were seated or stood in proximity to the deity during major festivals or rituals. By the order in which they received gifts from the deity, they received ritual status. In ritual terms, receiving gifts from a god or goddess elevated a devotee's own bodily substance. These gifts included the material remains of food that the deity had ritually partaken of, and the flowers that the deity had worn, imbued with its divine essence. The priests managed this social hierarchy under divine supervision of the deity and the earthly supervision of the king. Eventually, the sacred sites of especially powerful deities became major temple complexes with increasingly large palace-like houses, concentric surrounding walls, massive gateways, and large amounts of land and wealth under their control. In addition to professional priests, the largest and richest of these god-centered complexes supported large staffs of cooks, dancers, sculptors, and other workers and functionaries necessary to the deity's household. These complexes thus became economic as well as ritual centers for the local kingdom. As our prime example of the classic Dravidian model of the relationship between the king and the divine, and of the Sanskritization process, we can consider the Pandyan dynasty and the goddess Meenakshi in their major South Indian pilgrimage city, Madurai. Meenakshi conventionally has a green complexion and holds a parrot. She first emerged from a sacred pond full of golden lotuses. This suggests, in Edic terms, that she might have originally been a local Adivasi forest goddess taken over by Dravidian culture. Her names in Tamil, and also as translated into Sanskrit, mean the fish-eyed one, since her eyes had the shape of a beautiful carp. The earliest historical accounts have her as a Tamil-speaking, fierce, unmarried, meat-eating goddess. In Emic terms, her divine Shakti enabled the local Pandyan dynasty to conquer and rule the region for generations, with her Madurai home as the dynasty's capital. But after she was Sanskritized, the Brahmanic history of Meenakshi became that she was an all-Indian goddess poverty, the consort of the god Shiva. She had originally agreed as an act of grace to be born on earth as the daughter of the Pandyan king. The Pandyan king and queen had been promised a son, but instead they received a daughter with three breasts. They raised her as a warrior. She led the Pandyan armies to victory in all directions, over both earthly kings and also over all but one of the gods. But when she confronted Shiva, her husband in heaven and her husband-to-be on earth, her third breast disappeared. She became shy, and she accepted him as her lord. In one of the major rituals in the city of Madurai that has lasted for centuries is the reenactment of the wedding of Meenakshi to Shiva. The Brahmanic god Vishnu stood as the bride's brother, giving her to her groom. Being invited to attend this wedding and being seated near the ceremony remains for many leading people in the region a symbolic high mark of status. Today, the major temple in Madurai includes Meenakshi's original golden lotus pond and her special shrine, but they are now off-center, with the main part of the temple now being the home of Shiva and Meenakshi as a married couple. This vast temple complex dominates the heart of the original city of Madurai. Indeed, the streets encircle this temple. Different communities each have a neighborhood in the appropriate quadrant, as specified in the Vastu Shastra, the ancient Sanskrit instructional text that teaches the science of architecture. The historic Palace of the Kings lies in the southeast part of the city, not at its center. Further, a prime duty of the king was to donate land and riches to the deity. the hereditary attending Brahmin priests then use this wealth to enhance the worldly power of both the deity and the kingdom, as well as for their own income and that of the temple's many attendants and servants. In order to keep giving land to his guardian deity, the king needed to keep expanding his domain at the cost of his neighbors and their deities. This competition for land and wealth to donate to their god or goddess meant constant rivalry and warfare among neighboring rulers. By studying the copper plate inscriptions which list the donating king and receiving deity, we can trace over time the expanding and contracting frontiers of kingdoms. Thus, as we can see, the local cultural, social, and environmental conditions that were characteristic of South India were reflected in the distinctive prevailing Dravidian model of the deity, the king, the state, Brahmins, and the local society. Having concentrated on the Deccan and South India in this lecture, we'll turn in the next lecture to the Gangetic North and Indus Northwest regions of India during the same post-Mauryan period.